Hello, it's Dr. Howard Gurr here with Dr. Joe Elliott and our guest, Dr. Elizabeth McMahon, for another two guys talking about virtual reality therapy. And you, as have you've listened to us, know who we are, but you may not know who Dr. McMahon is. So I'm going to give you her bio. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to read it, so it doesn't look very technically capable, but here it is. Dr. McMahon specializes in evidence-based treatment for anxiety, and she's been using VR with her clients since 2010. She currently provides training and consultation in VR exposure therapy, looking at the benefits, the risks, integrative cognitive behavioral therapy, and for panic and fear and anxiety and related topics. She has a book, which I read and I think is great. It's Virtual Reality Therapy for Anxiety, A Guide for Therapists, which when I read it, I said, wow, this should be a text in VR. And of course, now I find out it is part of the Stanford Virtual Reality Immersive Technology Training Program. And Dr. McMahon has also written a client self-help book called Overcoming Anxiety and Panic, an Interactive Guide. And she has other publications and articles in peer-reviewed journals on VR and anxiety disorders. And she also has a webinar, Virtual Reality for Anxiety and Phobia Treatment, which is available through PESI, which is www.pesi.com. So, Elizabeth, welcome to Two Guys Talking About VR.
Thank you. I love talking about VR. This is going to be so much fun.
So my question right off the bat is, how did you wind up adopting VR in your own clinical practice?
Well, I became a specialist in anxiety for several years. And in 2008, I happened upon this article that said exposure using virtual reality was as effective as in vivo exposure. And I'm like, wait, what? I mean, you're telling me there's something I could do in the session that is as good, as effective, as impactful as the gold standard of in vivo exposure, which is, by the way, hard to get clients to do and uncontrolled. I was like, I got to know more about this. So I did a lit review and that supported it. I found the only three people I could find in all of Northern California who had ever used any kind of VR, and they all agreed it worked. And I was like, I got to have this for my clients. So at the time I was with Kaiser in one of their psychiatry clinics in Fremont, and I actually got funded. I got an innovation grant that allowed me to purchase for the clinic a VR setup. And then when I moved to private practice, I had just seen its effectiveness and knew I had to have it in my practice.
Very interesting. So Elizabeth, after you had been using XR, VR for a while in your practice, private practice, then you transitioned into training development. So how did that come about? What prompted that, and how did you go about doing it?
Well, you know, I'd been training postdocs for years at Kaiser. And so the idea of training and sharing what works has always been kind of one of my passions. And here I am with VR getting amazing results. And I'm like, you know, let me tell you about this great tool. I'd already published a client workbook on overcoming anxiety and panic. And so I thought, well, I would really like to share what I know with other therapists about, you know, you can use this and this is how you integrate it and this is how it works and here's the research support. And I wanted to write a book that was one clinician talking to another, you know, informally, supportively. And luckily, Rutledge agreed. And I wanted the book out there because after every webinar and workshop, therapists would come to me and say, this is amazing, and where can I learn more? So it just sort of developed organically.
How did you go about arranging for the CEUs, which are available for the clinicians that take your training course?
Well, I went through organizations that offer CEUs. So I've got webinars through the American Psychological Association. I've given webinars for the Association of Behavioral and Cognitive Therapies. There's a webinar available through the Anxiety Disorders Association of America. And then there's the webinar available through PESI.com. So all of these organizations have everything in place to give CEUs.
They handle the bureaucracy and you provide the content.
Exactly. Yes.
Right. You know, speaking about clinicians and using VR, I always tell people that I'm on Long Island. There are probably 2,000 clinicians, 2,000 licensed psychologists, I should say, on the island. And it's a very Long Island. And there are other mental health professionals who I don't know their numbers, but I could count on my fingers the number of clinicians who are using VR as we are in clinical practice. And I'm always stunned about how, I guess, it's not really known or understood, and the adoption rate is so low. And yet, as you said, Elizabeth, VR seems to be as effective as in vivo. And in my experience, I probably pretty much fall in line with the 90% success rate in terms of working with patients. And to me, that should be the gold standard in working with exposure therapy. And yet it falls on its face, so to speak. And so I guess my question is, what do you see as the barriers? Why is it not being adopted the way it should be?
Well, it's a really good question, because you're right. I agree with you. It's evidence-based. It's effective. It fits with what we know about effective treatment, particularly of anxiety disorders. It really, in my opinion, should be standard practice. I really think it should be best practice. So why is it not being adopted? Well, I think we run into a number of things here. Accepting anything new takes effort and time. We know that. So many therapists don't know about the benefits of VR, or else they don't know how or where to get trained. There are also common concerns, and the research has found this, and if these concerns are not addressed, even if therapists know how effective VR is, they'll be reluctant to adopt it. So the concerns are, oh, my clients won't accept it. Well, we know that's not true. Clients are seeking therapists who offer VR. There's a concern that VR is not going to be real enough. Well, you know, again, the research is very clear, and our clinical experience is very clear that you don't need vividly real VR to trigger anxiety. I remember treating a heights phobia when you'd get the person up on the virtual roof, and if they actually looked up, there was a visual seam in the sky, and yet none of my clients ever noticed it or said anything. You know, mm-hmm. VR doesn't need to be real to trigger anxiety. So then you've also got therapists who think, well, it's going to be too real. It's going to be traumatizing. It's going to be overwhelming. Well, you know, the beauty of virtual reality is that depending on the product, the program that you use, you can tailor the level of the exposure to your client's needs. So, you know, that actually makes exposure easier and less likely to be overwhelming. Now, some therapists worry the client's going to put on a headset, they're not going to see me anymore, so that's going to weaken the treatment alliance. And again, this is a valid enough concern that research studies have looked at it and not found that this is the case. Clinically, I can tell you, my clients feel closer to me. They are so deeply appreciative of having this tool offered to them. And I also don't just have them put on the headset and then sit there and leave them. I'm talking to them all the time. So they have me in their head. I'm checking with them. So no, if anything, it strengthens the treatment alliance. So I think there are two other barriers. One is people think, oh my God, tech, I'm not tech. Well, I'm not a techie. Mm-hmm. Let me just admit publicly that I was probably the last person that was still getting actual DVDs from Netflix. Okay? It's not that hard to run VR. The tech demands, it's really pretty intuitive. And I think the final barriers are therapists who just don't understand that exposure for anxiety is the best practice. They worry that it's traumatizing or they're somehow untrained or uncomfortable with exposure. So those are my thoughts. And then there's cost, right? You know, how much will it cost? Of course.
That seems to be the big one I get all the time. It's too expensive. And I say, well, you know, if you ordered a psychological test, it would be pretty expensive all by itself. You make it back up with administering the tests and charging patients for the tests. So it's no different. It's just another tool. I always thought that that was one of the issues. And then the last issue, and this doesn't really affect us too much, but I think it affects other practices, is that, well, insurance doesn't reimburse for it, which is also not true. But they get kind of upset because they think, oh, it's virtual reality therapy. It's not really therapy. And my position always is it is therapy. It's exposure therapy. It's just using a tool to enhance exposure therapy. And I would say to people like, well, if I was working with someone who had a fear of dogs and I brought a dog into the session to desensitize them to that dog, is that not therapy? All I'm bringing in is a virtual dog.
Or if you use imaginal exposure, mm-hmm. right? Exposure therapy is exposure therapy.
Exactly.
This is just an incredible tool. The other issue with cost is, frankly, this is going to bring, if you're in a small practice, and you know, this is going to bring you more clients. And it's going to bring you motivated clients who do well and right. then go out into the community and talk about what an amazing therapist you are.
Right. The downside of that, though, is because VR is so effective, the turnover rate is pretty high. So if you see someone for 8 or 9 sessions and you actually fix their problem in 8 or 9 sessions, they're done. And so it's like, you know, I know lots of people who have patients who are, pardon the expression, annuities, and they've been with them for 30 years and they expect them to come every week. Well, what happens when you cure their problem, and pardon the word, but fix their problem, and now they don't have to come back? Well, you have to replace that person. So it's almost like, you know, my father-in-law once told me that I have a very bad business model. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you fix people. They're supposed to be coming all the time. That way you have a constant income flow. And I go, well, that's not really what I'm doing. But but I think that's the downside also, because now you need turnover rate that people are kind of not anticipating, because they figure out, you know, my patient load will just be constant. Well, it's not constant when you actually help people get through this fast. So
you're right. It's not constant, but there's incredible gratification, mm-hmm. right? You are seeing the change within a relatively small number of sessions. People's lives are being changed. I mean, that's why we went into this profession. Plus, you can raise your rates because you're offering something that works and that not every therapist offers.
Right.
Yeah.
I love when you raise this point, Howie, because one thing we've discussed before, and that is our relative to business model. Perhaps you get a lot of your VR clients by a referral and you from other therapists who are working right. more generally with them. Whereas I most often have a brief course of VR treatment deploying VR tools to clients that have, especially air travel anxiety, but some others, maybe some, I have claustrophobia things, applications like that. But it is in a broader treatment relationship over time. So I'm wondering, Elizabeth, where do you fall percentage-wise between the clients who are coming specifically for a VR course versus broader relationship within which is a circumscribed VR course?
You know, I started out with a very brief focused therapy model, but even if 90 or 95% of the people that you see then get better in turnover, you still got the 5%, you know. So now what I have is, it turned into a hybrid practice. I would say 60% of people came to me specifically looking for virtual reality exposure therapy. And they're fairly fast. Maybe 5 to 10% are referrals from other therapists where someone's in longer term therapy, but they're coming to me to treat a phobia. And then the remaining 25% are people where maybe we started out working with phobia, and then that opened up other issues and gave them the alliance and the trust to be able to discuss deeper, longer term issues.
About a third of my practice comes from other clinicians who, in the process of their therapy, the patient said, oh, by the way, I have to fly somewhere in 6 weeks. And that therapist really can't get that patient there fast enough. And then they send them to me. I work directly with their phobias and send them back. But like your practice, mine is also kind of hybrid in that there are patients who are not VR patients. They have other issues that really VR doesn't lend itself to, or they are patients who started out with VR and then we got through their initial difficulty and then they went, oh, by the way, you know, I have this particular problem as well. And so, you know, we'd work on that in addition. So, you know, I would say to clinicians for the most part, you know, the VR is good for what it does in relationship to the patients who need it, but I don't know anyone has a complete 100% VR practice.
Right.
And I think that's also part of the issue here for clinicians, that they need to have the ability to adopt VR when it's necessary and when it's appropriate, but know that there are patients also who that may not necessarily be ideal for VR therapy.
You know, and we talk about VR therapy, or sometimes you'll hear the phrase VR therapist, and it's, you know, and I use the phrase, but it's also a misnomer, right? We are licensed mental health clinicians who do evidence-based broad psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. So if the tool is imaginal exposure, or if it is prolonged exposure, or if it is acceptance and commitment, or if it's mindfulness, or if it's, you know, insight, or if it's reflective listening, or if it's virtual reality for grounding or relaxation or exposure, right? You know, you have a broad toolkit. No therapist should only have one tool.
I think that's a prime takeaway from your work, Elizabeth, that I circled it in red in your book. And VR is a tool, not a treatment. I want to try to, because we use that shorthand, MHVR clinician, mental health virtual reality clinician, but it is a tool, not a treatment. We would love to hear your forecasts and hopes for the future trajectory of training and education of MHVR clinicians. What do you foresee?
Well, I really do see adoption increasing, spreading adoption over time. Every webinar and every workshop that I give, therapists are enthusiastic. And frequently, someone will come up to me afterwards and say, I'm going to introduce this to my staff. I'm introducing this to my clinic. I'm going to start using this in my practice. I believe the training in VR is going to be part of graduate school education, certainly for PhDs and psy. I think there are going to be more post-degree, post-licensure trainings in using virtual reality. I am starting to see more people adopt it. And frankly, I think training in VR as a tool may well start to be an optional part of training for healthcare clinicians, particularly those who treat pain or, you know, psychiatric MDs, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and for rehab professionals like physical therapists and occupational therapists, because again, the research supporting the use of VR in those fields is very strong. There are going to be more and more companies. It's gradual, but you'll see, I'm seeing, you know, a gradual increase in companies creating virtual environments, VR products, specifically designed for use in psychotherapy. And in general, right, in a free market where there's competition, cost will tend to drop. So I'm hoping that the cost will be less and therefore adoption that will also drive adoption. So those are my hopes.
You know, I don't think the costs are really that high in terms of the product. But my concern is simplicity. And, you know, just like you said earlier that, you know, you're not a tech person and most clinicians are not tech oriented. And I think they're intimidated by anything that looks technological. And I think that the concern I have is that if it doesn't get simplistic enough, that any clinician could pick up the technological side of it very quickly, then I think we're going to have issues. And so, you know, in response to your statement about companies, when I first started doing this, there was really only one or two major companies out there.
Right.
And I, in my own like obsessive quality, have been keeping track of all of the companies in the mental health field with VR. And I'm up to 118 worldwide. And I think that there's going to be a culling of these companies.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And the winners are going to come out ahead. And I think a lot of these startups are really going to, you know, fall by the wayside or get absorbed or merge somehow. And I think probably we're going to wind up with maybe two or three major players. But the only way that they're going to be successful is if they understand the marketplace and the clinicians that they're selling to and make the product so simplistic, one button, push, and you're in kind of thing, that's really what's going to make this, I think, take off. Because yes, it has to be cost effective, and yes, it has to be obviously evidence-based and effective, but it's got to be
people
reaching
like
the
us,
market.
We're
kind of
is essentially outliers.
And those are the people who in this particular field, even though
you're never going to be technological,
describe yourself as not technological, you took the leap. And I think that is a testament to the fact that you're forward thinking enough to look at this as an advancement in the field that
yes.
you were willing to step into. And
yes.
And I think that other people are just not there yet. And that's partially in my perspective due to the fact that VR is not there yet. You know, extended reality it's just not ubiquitous. It's not in everyone's home. It's
right.
not
right.
there so that everyone goes, oh, I can actually do this with it. And my experience has been, I don't know, Joe, I don't know how many headsets you have, but I have a box full of headsets. And I have to like literally force myself to go and recharge the batteries every once in a while because I'm not taking them out to use them all the time. And I have to remember, oh, I have to really update it and I have to charge the batteries to make sure it doesn't die in the box. But if that's me, I'm assuming, what does the average person do? Because my experience with even with my kids, who have, you know, Oculuses and all those. They play with it for about a month or so, and then it winds up in a closet.
Right. Kind of like most mental health apps, right? They get downloaded and the majority of them get opened zero to one times. So yes, you know, I absolutely agree with you. Making VR the ease of it costs and ease of use, because we truly have the evidence base. And frankly, that's what drove me to get this was, my God, this is as good as in vivo exposure. How can I not have it if I'm treating people with panic and phobia, you know? But yes, cost and making the user interface intuitive, which honestly, I think it's pretty intuitive for most of them. Not all, but, you know, but many of them. And easy for the client to use. And it has to be, in my opinion, a product that can be used in remote teletherapy as well as in the office. Because most of us post-COVID have hybrid practices. And teletherapy also allows people to come to you for this VR therapy anywhere in any state where you're licensed. And that also supports your practice and makes this available to more people.
Correct. I'm 100% remote. I don't see people in face-to-face since the pandemic.
Me too. Joe, what about you?
Well, I was going to add or agree about the hardware adding to the overhead expense. And hopefully that'll be part of the proliferation of the tool as there is some decrease in that, because currently we therapists have a few treatment suites that they can choose from. But then once you choose, you are married to the headset that it's ported to. My first was HTC working with the PTSD program, but then I found a different suite and needed to get an Oculus. And I know that Howie, you on your remote, you have used a couple of different headsets. And so once we choose our application, now we're kind of stuck these days, up until these days, we're stuck with particular hardware. Yes. So I know Elizabeth, in your PESI podcast, training podcast, you have a table off to your left where you pick up a whole bunch of headsets and are sharing it with the audience.
Yes, you're right. You know, ideally, if we get to one headset that's used, I really feel like what we ought to have is every company that's creating VR for psychotherapy ought to make it available so that you or the client can download an app on a mobile phone and put it in a $50 headset. So that bit of that price is no longer an obstacle for either you or your teletherapy remote clients.
So that's what Amelia does, as opposed to the other companies that require an Oculus or a Pico or a more advanced Sixth Degree of Freedom headset.
Right, right. Although just yesterday morning, I was consulting with another company where I'm on the advisory board and, you know, advocating for this. And they were saying that they're working toward June, having this now be available. So hopefully this will spread. If therapists buy the products that do this, right, the market can have some impact here on what's developed and what's made available.
Yeah, I think unfortunately there's a economic divide when you have a product line that requires a very expensive headset. It either eliminates a population of people who would be amenable to doing therapy with a cheaper headset and a cell phone, you know, head-mounted display in their cell phone. But clinicians are not going to be in the business of lending expensive headsets or patients are not going to be available to buy a $300 or $400 or $500 headset. Right. So I think that's where the cell phone is widespread, but not everybody has cell phones. So there is a population of people who don't even have cell phones. But I think that it's much broader population of people who are going to be seen using a cell phone as the engine with a cheap head-mounted display.
Exactly.
I think that's where, yeah, that's where things have to go. My hope is the marriage of AI and VR for behavioral health, in the sense that, you know, we talked earlier about the reality or lack of reality of certain virtual environments. And there are limitations, obviously, based upon which package, you know, you buy and what you're married to. But no company can produce the number and varied virtual environments that we would need to meet the needs of our patients. But if you could create an AI engine that generates the virtual environment that you want, like a Sora, which enables you to create an AI virtual environment, a visual environment based upon text input, that would be phenomenal. And yeah. I think that would also probably eliminate some therapeutic resistance, because when they say, well, it's not real, or it doesn't meet my patient's needs, well, you create any environment, therefore, you know, you can meet everybody's needs.
Exactly. And I think that might be particularly effective for OCD, where the triggers are so widespread. I mean, if we're talking heights or flying or claustrophobia or even public speaking, you know, it's a fairly standard stimuli. But OCD, it could be driving away and thinking you left the door ajar. It could be touching a doorknob. It could be stepping on a sidewalk. It could be having someone cough next to you. I mean, there's so many. So, no, that's a very intriguing future use.
That's what I'm hoping I could find in somebody in AWE is doing something like that we could integrate that.
I suspect that that will be the case, and we will find that that is why I am hoping that developers and creatives will come in and attend the panel that we're all going to be participating in, because the multidisciplinary teaming up to produce the kind of things we're talking about here is the way forward. And what you're describing, what we've talked about, where it needs to go to be more economically feasible. Well, we are the growing market. You know, we're in an epoch of expansion beyond the enterprise level of consumers or focus down to the, or out to the private small agency and private practitioner. We're their market. So we will have a chance to dialogue with the creators at AWE and tell them, hey, if you make something that looks like this, we will buy it from you.
And if you make something looks like that, we won't. You know, and don't just get an idea and then go off. Please, please, please continue to consult with psychotherapists who are using this and doing therapy about what will actually work, because there are a lot of golly gee whiz, wouldn't it be amazing we could do this, that actually have nothing to do with how you do therapy.
Absolutely. You know, I actually have a personal experience. Our son is a soldier, and his unit just recently tested 7 systems of mixed reality for the battlefield. They did live tests of them, and they had been cheered in the press for a couple of years. And he and his unit of soldiers went out and ran with them and came back and said, 2 of them, we said, okay, we can use that. 4 of them, he said, there is, who came up with this? It doesn't make sense. We will not use this except to our own peril. But it was already decided ahead of time by the tech guys that, oh, the soldiers can use this. they apparently didn't talk to soldiers. So analogously, it would be great if the devs and the creatives would talk to us.
Talk to the user. Right, exactly.
Yeah, I always define myself as an end user.
We are.
Yes.
We are, which adds a unique perspective for the devs, mm-hmm. because they think of end user as the game players, or and we're a it's middle level. Absolutely.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Folks, we're out of time.
I knew that was gonna happen.
This
I knew
went pretty quickly.
Yes. Yes.
Elizabeth, it was great talking to you. It's nice to know that you are available to speak to us on this particular platform. And we're looking forward to June when we're going to be at Long Beach at AWE. And hopefully we could convince some developers to see it our way.
Right.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. No, this was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
I was so pleased to get to finally see your face in live time, having read your work, seen your courses, exchanged a lot of emails, and now we're just a couple of months away from an actual handshake. So, but thank you so much for taking the time to share with us. It has been a privilege and a pleasure.
Pleasure was all mine. Take care.
So until next time, it's two guys talking about VR. See you soon. Bye-bye.